Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It could even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy.
Dave Holmes.
Hello.
Thank you for being here on Failing Up. We appreciate it. Of course, I'm Guy. Eden, how are you today?
I'm all right.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Just all right.
It's a good LA day.
Yeah, it really is.
It's a gorgeous day. We've had a really good week.
Yeah.
So I'm thankful for that.
Yeah.
Nice lower 70s kind of thing. I went hiking today. It's very, very exciting.
Lovely.
Oh, yeah.
We're so spoiled. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. It's like people are like freezing. They had like a snowstorm in Denver last week.
Yeah. I am in New York a lot for work and I can't do it. Like I've turned a corner and I am too soft to handle it. I can't handle rain. I can't handle extreme temperatures of any kind. I just can't, like, I can't do it. I can't do it and work. Like you can't expect me to like deal with rain and show up in an office and like not look like a monster.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I've been spoiled here.
Yeah.
And I feel like when it rains here, and people want me to look good for something, I'm like, forget it.
But you know what? Like here, it happens so rarely and it's a thing. And so if you show up looking like a mess, it's fine. Like you get a pass.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. People take it as a sick day.
Like, yeah.
I can't
exactly.
show up.
Once you get used to calling 65 degrees freezing, that's when it's hard to go back to New York.
I was here for 1 year and I remember I used to live kind of in this neighborhood and I went to Molly Malone's and then I walked home after. And I was like, I'm fucking freezing. Like I had a light jacket, but it wasn't enough. I was like, God, this is a real cold snap. Like, and I went and I checked like my thermometer at home and it was 58 degrees. And I was like, oh, I guess it takes a full year for your blood to fully like thin and for you to really become an LA person.
I'm from here, so I'm like, there's no cracking it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is I lived in New York during the summers.
Yeah.
So I couldn't even, that's like the why I was like, I can never move here because it was so hot and humid.
So disgusting.
Yeah.
It's so disgusting.
It's smelly and
it smells like rat piss and like, I'm sorry, it's disgusting, but like, and you're just gross. You just have a sweaty back every minute of every day.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
I'm afraid to hug people on the street in New York because it's like, don't even touch me. I'm gross.
Yeah. I'm super spoiled because I work from home. And so, you know, I mean, if I'm on like a set, then I'm on a set or whatever. But now sometimes I have to be in an office, and it's been 18 years since I've had to be in an office, and it's just like I don't know what to do. I'm like perpetually nervous in an office because I'm conscious of how loudly I'm speaking and like whether I'm wearing the right thing and like are my shoes okay, and it's very strange.
Well, LA offices I've noticed are a little different. Like
they are. Yeah, This is like this is a New York office at a men's fashion magazine, basically.
Right.
So it's like, I feel very.
That's, I think, a different category.
It is a whole different intimidating category.
Yeah. I don't think I'd be able to get dressed in the morning if I knew I had to go to a men's fashion magazine. Like, you even pointed it out. I'm wearing a Yankees cap and a Yankees shirt. Like, that's the height of my style there. So
I have one extra button undone for Prince.
I've
been doing it in the last few days. I don't know anything really flashy or silky or purple. But I can do I can undo a button.
That's enough.
That's enough, right?
Yeah, totally.
Is that it? I mean, have you not been watching Purple Rain or
seen Purple
Under
Rain?
Under a Cherry Moon?
I've hosted two different vinyl nights at my house, and I think probably tonight will turn into a third.
Good.
Wow.
I think there really has been a lack of like Prince. There were so many Bowie parties, I remember.
Oh, there will be Prince parties.
Okay, because
I'm going to one tomorrow night.
Okay.
I'm
Bar
glad Lubitsch.
There are some. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Chip Pope is going to DJ.
Oh,
it's
nice.
Be great.
All right.
Well, whose death affected you more, Bowie or Prince?
Prince?
Prince, really?
100%, yeah.
Why?
Because he was my generation, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, Purple Rain came out the summer between 7th and 8th grade for me, which is just like, that is the time when all the best shit comes out, is when you're 13, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember, I just had this, one of the guys I was with came out with this memory, which I had forgotten, but now I remember it so vividly. I had a sleepover at my house. I had, my two best friends over, summer between 7th and 8th grade. We couldn't see Purple Rain because it was rated R, but we all bought our own copies of the soundtrack. Like, we hung out at our house, we had dinner, then we went to the mall, we all bought Purple Rain, and then we went back to my house, and it was John and Derek. John had, a bowl cut, and, I was just starting to, use mousse and, think about my hair, and Derek was very spiky and had, a fingerless glove and the whole thing, and we were like, we need to fucking fix John's hair. And I remember, like, I had some Studio Line mousse, and we were like, John, we're going to fix your hair. We're going to give you a new look. Like, it couldn't have been a gayer bunch of boys. Well, Derek and I ended up being gay. John did not. But we went at his hair with mousse, and I remember my oldest brother walked past the bedroom as we were, like, doing and talking about and, like, cooing over hair, and I remember him giving a look, like, I know this is audio, but just, like, a look of, like, total perplexed horror that right. three boys were talking about hair. And I remember at that moment, listening to Prince, I didn't care. You know what I mean? Because it was like, you know,
I'm going to be weird.
Yeah. Yeah, I can do whatever the fuck I want to do in this world.
Yeah, totally.
That's awesome. Yeah, you just wrote a whole article about him. And
his new look looked awesome.
That was the original Queer Eye for the Straight Guy.
It kind of was.
You fixed straight men in dire need of help.
It's what we do. It's our purpose in this world, really.
Really.
That was the pilot episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I was saying you just wrote a whole article about Prince and what he meant to you. And you were in the same room as him at TRL.
I was, right? He came in. And it was just, you know, it was one of those things where, like, everybody, there were certain days when somebody would come in and like people would have a reason to stop by the studio, like they would hand deliver a memo or whatever, and it was like, you don't need to be, you could have put in that in an office mail, but like everybody wanted to be there, and Prince was there, and you understood it, and he came in, and he had, as I said in the article, he had a security guard whose whole job was to hold the swear jar, and if you swore, you were supposed to put in a buck. And he was late, and he just couldn't have cared less. And like, it was just, and we were just all in awe of him. You know, he was radiant.
He was a different caliber. I think. Like,
he totally was.
It's like, well, you're gonna get mad at Prince for being late.
Yeah,
like, you can't.
Oh no. Yeah, Prince lives in his own world and goes by his own clock. And I, you know, I don't know. I mean, of course, I love David Bowie also, but Prince was really a part of my youth.
You know,
he was really, you know, I just always loved him.
Do you guys at all feel like a need to find out exactly what happened?
Yes.
You do?
Yeah.
Why is that? So for me, like, there is a piece of me that wants to do it, and then there's a piece of me that's disgusted by myself.
Yeah.
Where it's like, why do you need to know that stuff?
Well,
right?
Because you're curious. You're a human being, and you're curious. And and he seemed to have been the picture of health. You know, he seemed to be clean living. He was very, you know, he was really religious. I don't think he drank. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it was such
it's
a
so
shock.
So fishy.
Yeah, it's very strange. And now, you know, we're hearing all this stuff. Like, the idea of him being brought down by Percocet makes me want to fucking throw up. Like, it's just too much.
I think the reason why people are having this interest is that it is so shocking. Mm-hmm. It's not like he was, you know, Doris Roberts, who was 90. We're like,
right. We don't need to know what happened to Doris Roberts.
I know.
You know?
Yeah.
I demand an autopsy.
Yeah. Yeah, and even David Bowie. I mean, you knew that he had been sick.
Exactly.
But but this comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, he was just in Atlanta doing a show, mm-hmm. so it's really confusing.
Yeah, it's very confusing.
Well, you know,
very
there was confusing. A pretty well-known tweeter that passed away in, like, the last year, that kind of, like, under mysterious circumstances.
Yeah.
And I went out of my way to, like, what happened to this guy?
I know, too.
I wasn't best friends with him by any means, but I was, like, buddies enough that I'm like, what happened? And then it took me, like, literally, his friends actually kept it very close, and it took me months.
Well, it took them some time to figure it out.
What
completely.
Did happen?
Booze and pills is what I hear.
Really?
Yeah.
Ugh, God almighty.
And everybody knows something like that, so I don't even want to say. I mean,
yeah, no.
We all, I think we're fans of him. Anyway, let's talk about a young Dave Holmes.
Why not?
What is a young Dave Holmes like?
Super terrified of not being normal, you know? Okay. Like,
no wonder you loved Prince.
Yeah. I was obsessed with pop culture. I loved to read. I loved movies. I loved music. And I had two older brothers who were very, very normal, like, you know, and just effortlessly like what men were supposed to be. And they're like 8 and 10 years older than I am. So that it was as though I grew up in like a four parent household kind of. And I'm very not like the rest of my family. I love my family, but I'm not like them in a lot of ways. And so I always felt very uncomfortable about that. And I just kind of wanted to be like my brother. I wanted to be like a normal person. And so I tried very hard all throughout my youth and early adulthood to just like make myself regular and normal and like the kind of person who would put on a tie and go to an office and just be, you know, and talk about baseball and be, you know, a regular boy.
You were into music more than other people though. Did you recognize that?
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah.
What was it? Was it like an escape for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was also a way to connect to my brothers because they went to college. in the late 70s, early 80s, when like great fucking college music was coming out. So like they would come back with the Clash and like the English Beat and the Specials and shit. And it was like, that fucking blew my mind. And it sort of gave me an identity. Mm. So if like, you know, if I was like the kid with like the, you know, the English Beat pin on his jacket, it was like, I was sort of like cool and punky or whatever, right, in a way. And like, I wasn't a very good athlete. I wasn't, you know, I was not a great student. And so being into music sort of became like, it was my way to have a personality, yeah, kind of. And then I also, like when I was 15, there was a really good college station in my town. And I listened to it all the time. And I was just like, I'm going to try to get a job there. Like, I'm just going to lie and say that I'm a student there because I looked a little bit older. And I rode my bike there and I lied and I said I was a freshman. And they gave me a show on Saturday afternoon. So, wow, I got to like DJ,
yeah,
all through high school, which was so much fun. You know?
So wait, I'm sorry, you're a freshman in high school when you did
this? I was
a
freshman in high school, yeah.
And you told them you're a freshman in college. And yeah, nobody checked.
And it was like a Saturday afternoon shift when, you know, people would rather be, you know, napping or whatever. Right. It was just like something that sat empty for a long time. And so I took it. And it was, you know.
Did somebody teach you how to use the equipment? Or mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Just like a regular, you treated like a college student, essentially.
Fake it. They're like, oh yeah, I know what I'm doing.
No, and okay, then I eventually had to come out of the closet as a 16-year-old. but by then I was like, I had made myself indispensable because yeah, I was just, you know, I was trying to do as many things at the station as I could do just to learn. So I did.
Were you good off the bat?
Probably not. But I felt good. And it kind of didn't matter. Like, the thing about college radio was that it was a little bit scruffy. And you know, like, if you fucked up, it was no big deal. So, yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I mean, I felt like I was okay. You know, I haven't heard a tape of myself from those days in a really long time.
Oh, we should have found one or tried to find
one. I would love to find one. I'm sure they must exist somewhere.
And you didn't tape yourself?
I'm sure I did. Yeah, I mean, you had to do air checks and like, go over them with the program director or whatever. Yeah. So I'm sure I did. But I don't have those anywhere. And what I used to do was I would just not talk for 45 minutes at a time and make myself a mixtape. You know, I would just, yeah, put a tape in and just play like 15 great songs in a row. And then I would have like a tape for my car or for parties or whatever.
That's smart.
So I kept a lot of those.
Was the show just music, say just something about music, the song, music, say something? Or
yeah, what? It was like, yeah, we would talk about, you know, talk about the music. We would do PSAs and yeah, stuff. But it was commercial free and I mean, it could not have been easier. It was much more fun than my actual college radio ended up being,
yeah,
because I think we wanted to be halfway professional.
Oh,
and that was not as much fun.
My college radio station was a mess. You just, yeah, made me think about it. And really? I'm like, oh, it was like our shows were just so bad.
Yeah.
And yeah. It was terrible. It was really, yeah, but that's, yeah, I guess.
Where'd
that's
you go
the
to
fun
college again?
Rutgers.
Okay. Rutgers.
Oh yeah.
What was that station again?
WRL. Well, the one I was on was WRLC in Piscataway, but okay, there was also one called Shit, I should know that.
Okay.
My college radio station wasn't even in my college. It was some other college, like 30 miles away.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm not going to drive there to get a job.
Yeah, no, hell no.
I love radio so much that I once did a show for a station that worked. It did work online, but really the only way to listen to the actual radio station was to sit in the parking lot and turn on.
Wow. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was so, like 50 watts, and it was worse than any college radio station I've ever, yeah, been on, but it's something I cared about enough that, I mean, obviously, you know, you care about music so much that it, I don't know. I don't think I would have had the balls at 14 or 15, yeah, to go, hey, I'm going to, yeah, go to a college and start, yeah, being on the radio.
Yeah, I don't know. I just felt like I had to do something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I love to perform and stuff, but, you know, there are only so many shows that I could do, right, at, yeah, a time. And, yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to do something that nobody else was doing.
How crazy about music were you? Like, I'm a big Howard Stern fan, and his producer, yeah, Gary, is like, I was just listening to coming up here, he read the liner notes as he's listening, sure, to each album and, like, he was excited because this one guy was the person who was clapping in the background of a Linda Ronstadt song. And, like,
yeah,
is that the kind of stuff that you would pay attention,
yeah,
to?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, I think my boyfriend now is a composer. And so when we listen to music, he'll talk about, like, oh, this is too, I don't like the compression on this or whatever. And I have no fucking idea what he's talking,
right,
about.
Right, yeah, right.
Or like what mastering is. He's explained it to me and I still don't understand what it is. And I don't care. You know what I mean? I just don't,
yeah,
care.
Yeah.
And so like when I'm seeing a band live, I don't notice, mm-hmm, like, you know, if the drummer's tempo is off or whatever. Like, those are not things that I know. I'm not like, it's like with wine. Like, I will, wine will remind me of things, but I don't taste pencil shavings or anything like that. You know what I mean? Like,
it's
I
woodsy.
Just, yeah. Like, I'll take a whiff and I'll be like, oh, it reminds me of this time when I did that thing or whatever. And it makes me very happy. But like with music, I think I was really into the marketing of it and people's look and like what it said in a, you know, in a larger sense or whatever. Like,
so many aspects to it.
Yeah.
More than just what you hear.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I was obsessed with the visual aspect of it because, you know, I mean, MTV came along when I was 10. And I think we got it when I was like 13 or 14. And I watched it nonstop. And it was so colorful and weird and arty and so the opposite of like Catholic conservative Midwesternness.
You know? Yeah.
Right. Absolutely.
So were you a broad music fan or was it like pretty much rock and roll?
I listened to pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, everything. I hate to say everything but country, but everything. But
I
country,
know.
Yeah.
I feel like the same way though. Yeah. Everything but country.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, and there's some country that I do like. It's just a lot of it is so corny.
Yeah,
it's a lot. A lot of it sounds the same to me.
Yeah,
that's the reason.
And I would, but the thing is, I wouldn't judge all of like rock by, you know, Maroon 5 or Nickelback or whatever.
That's not rock.
You know what I mean?
That's like true. Pop rock.
Right.
Yeah, but I also think that probably, you know, Luke Bryan isn't really country.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Yeah. And there is some, there's obviously some great stuff out
there.
Yeah. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I know that there is. It must be. It must exist.
Let's take people back a little bit, though.
Please.
In the 80s, I mean, MTV was like, for young people, I mean, I was a young person back then, too. Mm-hmm. That was like, it was counterculture. It was like your parents didn't want you to watch it. It had the coolest shit on there and stuff. And I mean, I couldn't even imagine what you did, which is obviously you ended up working for them, but you also joined the Who Wants to Be a VJ. How'd you even hear about the contest in the first place?
I was working at my advertising job, which I sucked at. I was terrible. And I had in fact been fired from not this job, but a previous job. And I was temping, and then I finally got back into the world of advertising, and I continued to suck at it. And I was, this was kind of in, not in the early days of the internet, but like late early days of the internet. And every Thursday morning, I would go to billboard.com and look at the charts and see what was going on. And on billboard.com, there was a news item that said MTV was going to do an open call for VJs. And I was like, well, that's what I'm going to do. That's just what I'm going to do. Because I was doing improv shows at night, and I was like, I had basically by this time said to myself, like, this is not what I do. You know what I mean? Like, being normal is not working out for me.
And you graduated college?
I did, yeah.
What was your degree?
I studied psychology.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And I had every intention of going to graduate school and being a therapist and all that shit, but like, I decided to take a couple of years and just make some money. I mean, not that there's a lot of money to be made in advertising, but I was like, I want to have a real job for a while and then decide if I want to go back to school. So I did, and I didn't like advertising, but I did like working and being out of school and all that. So after like maybe 4 years, I was like, this is not, I need to start figuring out an exit strategy because I don't have kids. I'm probably not going to have kids. I'm far from my family. I'm in New York, which is so expensive and so hard to live in, and like doing all these things to myself, and then I'm going to a job that I hate and I'm terrible at. What the fuck? What's going on? I'm only got one life. So I was like, all right, I need a plan. And I didn't really have one, but I would just take myself to like whatever audition I could take myself to, and I did, you know, a lot of shitty comedy shows and whatever. Anyway, one of the auditions was the Wanna Be a VJ one, which I thought like I'll either, like at worst, I'll just get to be inside the MTV studios for a minute, which like that would be enough. You know what I mean? Like I just to see it and see how people work and like get somebody's business card and see if I could send them like a writing sample or get myself in as like a, I didn't know what a production assistant was at the time, but like I knew that there were, you know, people would need to be brought coffee or something.
Right.
Like, anything. So I thought, yeah, I'm just going to get in the door and just see what happens. And then it like, it in this blur that I still, it's still kind of a patchy memory to me. I ended up, like, I didn't get the job, but I got the job.
So let's talk about that.
So let's talk about it.
There's this contest.
There's this
contest. You find out about it. There's more to it. I mean,
well,
you were working at the time, you quit your job.
I'll explain the thing. I thought that it was an audition, and it was, but there was also a live TV element. So you went in, and it was sort of American Idol style, where you like...
I remember watching it.
Really?
Yeah. I remember...
Fucking weird.
I remember watching it, because I was pretty little. I'm younger than you guys. But I remember, I was of course, like, I want to know what's going on MTV. I want to be cool.
Yeah.
And I think I was like 14 or something. And I remember, and I just felt really bad for these people, because it was like American Idol, kind of gut-wrenching.
It was a little bit. I mean, it predates all of those kinds of shows.
Right.
But there were like... they would have lower down, like, actually not even casting people, just like people from the marketing department or legal or whatever would volunteer for the day and like see sort of the everybody who came in. There were 12 audition stations. They would bring us in 12 at a time. And then if the person liked you, they would like, it was like an instant callback, which, and so they, then you would go and meet the casting people. So I did. And I ended up being there for maybe an hour or something.
Slow down for 1 second. Are you, you're in line. You know this is going to happen. Are you like, what the fuck am I going to say? Are you nervous at all?
I was weirdly calm. I was weirdly calm. Because the whole thing was so utterly surreal that I was like, I think if I had had... Now, if I were to do it now, I would cry. You know what I mean? Like, it would just be a nervous...
Too much pressure.
It's a different age now, though.
Like, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. We didn't have phones back then, even, to like judge each other.
No.
Just beepers. Yeah.
Just beepers. Yeah, I remember I brought a Walkman so that I wouldn't have to listen to people because I had done enough auditions by then to know that like people are really trying to psych each other out and whatever, and it's like, get the fuck out of here with that. But I remember I got in early. I got in line at like 4 a.m. because I figured I had to get in early. You know, I needed to be one of the first people they see if I was going to have a chance at all. And just for whatever reason, this guy that I talked to in my initial audition, or what I guess I read cue cards and answered a couple questions. I really don't remember much about it. And then he sent me off to meet with the casting people. I talked to them for another half hour and they put me on tape a little bit. And then I went home and I called in sick and they were like, we'll get back to you by midnight on Tuesday if you make the top 10. And then they told me like that it was going to be, and there were a million, like all the local news was there. There was a ton of press.
Whoa,
it was really crazy. So they were like, once we get to a top 10, then it'll be a live televised thing over the course of, for like Wednesday to Saturday. So I was like, okay. And then I called in sick for the next day as well. Cause I was like, first of all, I was shitty at my job. So like I was
no loss there.
No loss to them at all. I'm sure everything went much more smoothly without me there, but I was like, I need the full day to like fixate and focus. So I did.
Did you have any indication? Like when you left, you're like, I nailed it or I did okay. Or?
Yeah. I felt weirdly confident. I felt really weirdly confident about it.
Yeah.
And I'm not a confident person by and large. Like I typically don't, like nailed it is not a thing that I think a lot about myself.
Nailed it. Yeah.
That's not, those are rarely words that I say to myself, but I did, I felt good, but I also didn't know what it was to nail. You know what I mean? It was just, they were looking for personalities, I guess. And like, you know, I knew for myself that I was not a big character. So like, if I was going to get through it all, it was going to be for being like a regular guy. Like I would be in the regular guy slot.
Right.
You know what I mean? So anyway, so they said they had to call by Tuesday at midnight and they called on Tuesday at like 11:58 or something.
Wow. Nice.
And then I was in the top 10. So then I had to call in sick for the rest of the week.
Nice.
And I went back in on Wednesday morning and like was in the green room and we spent the whole day like answering questions on tape about our favorite music and doing all these things and, you know, filling out a billion forms. And then on, there was no such thing as TRL yet. There was MTV Live. And I was on MTV Live that afternoon, and the guests were NSYNC. It was their first ever TV appearance.
Jeez.
Chris Kattan. And then like a celebrity board of like VJ people. So like Kennedy and John Norris, Kurt Loder maybe. And we had to talk about music. We had to interview Chris Kattan. We had to do all kinds of shit. And then at the end of that, now I'm giving you too much information. Now at the end of that, they narrowed us down to 5.
Yeah.
And then Thursday, Friday, and then all day Saturday, there was this live event where people got to call in and vote. And that was how they like chose a person. And they did not choose me, which is all right.
When you sit down, when you get in this room, 10 people that are with you, obviously you're sizing people up, right? Do you recognize, oh, this person's probably going to do well?
Okay. Well, there was a guy named Jesse who did win and who was a really big character.
Yeah. He was huge
Jesse
character.
He was a really big character.
But where is he now? Like, I haven't heard from him.
Well, he makes appearances here and there. And when he does, everybody on the internet tells me about it.
Okay. Well, Dave would know.
Yep. I do only for that reason. I mean, we didn't stay in touch. But anyway, he was like this very tall, kind of crazy heroiny looking guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just turned up. He was on MSNBC at a Bernie rally.
of course he was.
The morning of the New York primary, there was a rally and some MSNBC reporter found him. And I don't think he identified him as Jesse Camp, but he put him on camera and then like literally 1,000 people sent him to me.
is that annoying or are you just...
It was annoying like 3 months in. when I did start working there, like people would ask me about them all the time, and I was like, when is this going to stop? And now it's 18 years later and it hasn't stopped. And it's like, it was annoying early, but then very shortly after that, it was like, well, it's never going to stop. Yeah. So I might as well, like, get comfy with it, because this is what it's going to be. And if that's the price that I pay for getting to do what I get to do for a living, I'll pay it.
Absolutely.
I'll pay it gladly.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the second that he walked into the green room, he was the last to arrive. And when he came in, I was like, well, this is the guy who's going to win. Like, it was so clear. Because, I mean, if you give a viewer the chance to vote, especially an MTV viewer, chance to vote on something that is ultimately as, like, inconsequential and silly as, like, who's going to be the next VJ on the network or whatever, of course they're going to choose the crazy one to see what happens.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would. Maybe I wouldn't.
Was there anybody else that was, like, that ended up doing anything celebrity-wise?
There was, actually. The woman who came in third is an actress named Keely Sanchez.
Okay.
She has been in a ton of shows and movies. What was she in recently? You can look it up. K-I-E-L-E Sanchez. Beautiful and very talented. And she got an agent the Monday after the thing. Like, somebody at ICM called up and was like, we got you.
It's kind of like when I used to watch America's Next Top Model. I don't anymore, but like when it first started, I was interested.
Yeah.
And it's like, I thought to myself, well, even if you don't win that,
yeah,
like everybody there is going to get a contract. Like, sure. I'm not worried about these people.
Yeah. Yeah. What's to be worried about? And like, and American Idol, which I did watch and will again when it comes back in 2 years.
Syndication. Yeah.
They're going to reboot it very soon. But like all of those people, they'll end up on Broadway or like, even if you're in some shitty show in Branson.
They all did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, every one of them will land somewhere good. And like, maybe it's not like a cool job that you get or whatever, but like,
it's
better than what you were doing before.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And like, it's very easy to like look down your nose at somebody who like does a show in Branson, but they, guess what? They get to fucking sing for a living.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
They're not like, working at an advertising agency.
Yeah. That's what they want to do. Yeah. Yeah. And I've had some like shitty TV jobs as well, but it's like, this is in the neighborhood of what I want to do.
Right.
So few people in the world get to do what they want to do with their lives. Like, I'm very lucky.
Yeah. I have that moment sometimes where I'm like, why do I have to do this like gig where I have to like travel? But I'm like, wait, I'm doing like 5 minutes of work or like something like that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, very lucky people. Yeah. We're very, very lucky people.
So a big theme, obviously, of the show, Failing Up, is failing. And so in a sense, right, coming in second place is a failure.
It was public failure.
How did you, like, if you're saying you walked in, you knew for yourself Jesse was going to win.
Yes.
So when he won, was it like, of course he won?
Yes. But I mean, there was a moment just before they announced, because of course, you know, again, like, this was kind of the first of its kind, and like now those moments at the end take forever. I mean, like American Idol, they stretch it out forever.
Yeah.
But at the time it was like, it seemed like it took forever, but it was probably just like a very quick thing. But I remember in that moment thinking like, what if they call my name? You know what I mean? Like, what if? Like, I guess I could, like, I'm one of the two people left standing here. I could win, you know?
Right.
But I didn't. And that's totally fine. And like, the only thing, I just burped, excuse me. The only thing that kind of stunk about it was that, like, in addition to getting hired and getting like a salary, he got like a $25,000 like bonus thing or whatever. But I remember thinking remembering in the moment, like when I saw him first walk into that green room, I was like, okay, the plan is to lose well. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I'm not going to win, but I could get a job. Like, I'm the only, because I think it was like 26. I was the oldest person there by a good 4 or 5 years. And I was also, I think, the only person who was taking it somewhat seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, like, I mean, I think I was the only one who was aware that there were other things that I could do at that network and other ways that I could make myself useful. So the job that week was to meet as many people and shake as many hands and like look at it as like a networking opportunity, you know?
Right.
And so I did. And so like in that moment, I was of course disappointed. And it's also like, it's kind of embarrassing. And like I had skipped a good college friend's wedding that weekend. And so I knew that they were all like, they had all like slipped out to the bar of the wedding reception to watch the end of it and whatever. And I was like, oh, and all I could think about was them like seeing me lose. And it was like, oh, in a lot of ways, it was embarrassing, but it was like, all right, you don't Like, you do not have time to be embarrassed. You don't have time to feel any type of way about what's going on. What you've got to do is go to that fucking wrap party and collect business cards. Yeah. And like plan B starts right now.
Right.
Wow. So I did. And it like, it worked out. And I was like, I remember being very aggressive about calling every single person who I had met until they agreed to take a meeting. Because I was like, as nice as everybody was, and as much as they were like, oh, we should, you know, you should call, maybe we'll find something for you to do, people forget.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm just gonna fucking be shameless about it. Like, the worst I can hear is no, you know? And then I go back to my life, which wasn't that bad. But anyway, so I got back in, I took a zillion meetings, I got myself a job doing like writing weekend specials and stuff. And then just because I was around the hallways and people did have kind of a fond feeling toward me because I did lose on national television. And I think they, you know, like felt pity probably. They started putting me on tape for things. And like, I would screen test for various new show ideas as they popped up, and one got picked up and they brought me on.
See, I think it's an amazing lesson to learn right there. You kind of gloss right by it. You don't even think about what you did, but like a lot of people in that moment.
If you're gonna fail, fail right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because a lot of people at that moment, they would be devastated.
Sure.
Right? They would at least take time to themselves. Definitely not that same night go be like, oh, here's what my future is in collecting these business cards. Then the third thing that really popped up for me, last week's guest kind of said the same thing that you said, which is like he said, he called people 10 times, right? Just because he wanted to get this one job. They weren't getting back to him. Called 10 times. And you kind of said the same thing where it's like, you don't just call once.
Right.
You keep calling till somebody calls you back and you get what you want.
Yeah. Oh yeah, keep trying. And like, you cannot take it personally if somebody, somebody forgets you, if somebody says like, oh, I really want to work with you, and then they don't follow up or whatever. It's not malice, and it's not like, it's not insincerity. It's just, that's the way life goes. Like, every new day brings you a whole bunch of new things, and it rejiggers all the things that are already in your head. Like, things fall through the cracks in my life all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And I wish that they didn't, but they do because I'm a person and my brain is flawed. So just keep fucking going. The worst that you're ever going to hear is like, stop calling me. And you probably won't hear that.
I made a vow to myself, like, not like a resolution because it was too late by then, but I was like, if I want something, I'm going to just ask people for it.
Yeah.
I don't care anymore. I used to be like really complacent and like, I'll just be polite, but like, that's the only way I'm going to get my way.
Yeah.
And the worst someone says is like, no, I can't help you.
Right.
But they might direct me somewhere where I can get what I want.
Right.
So I'm pro doing that. And then
absolutely.
I read somewhere that also like, you know, women get paid less than men. And apparently that's not true. Women just don't negotiate their salaries more, which pissed me off. So I'm like, yeah, I think we should just ask for more. I think women are just like, well, if that's what you're giving me, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I'm shitty at negotiations.
Absolutely. I need people to come with me to get a car because I'm bad at that. Oh,
God, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, are you sure there are no other fees that I can pay you? Are there no taxes or tariffs that I can put
on
there?
Like,
undercoding? Sure? Don't I need undercoding?
Yeah.
So especially at that time when we didn't have phones and we weren't like so cluttered in our head with like Facebook and Twitter and just all these social media, you know, ways of getting in touch with people. That's really like, you actually had to call people.
I had to pick up a physical telephone that was attached to my wall. I didn't have a cell phone yet. And like, an email was not, I mean, it was a thing, but it was not your primary mode of communication.
No. It was
like something you would like check once a day.
Right.
You know? If that.
So it took balls to actually pick up the phone and call someone. Like, well, schedule it.
Again, it was just like, here's the thing that I learned from doing improv, which I had told you I was doing at night. And like, the shows that we did were, you know, they were decent, but not great. You know, and I was like slowly sort of getting better. But like, my first improv teacher gave me the best lesson ever, which was, as you go forward and as you like walk out on stage or when you go into an audition or whatever, you're of course going to be terrified because it is intimidating, but you're an actor, so act like a confident person. Just go in and like, just really play the part of a confident person. And like, before long, you'll trick yourself into being confident. Mm-hmm. Just pretend that you are. Stand straight, smile, like do all of those things. So I was already sort of practicing that, and it was like, this was just kind of an extension of that lesson. Like, I'm just gonna, this confident character that I'm playing is going to call all these people until they agree to take a meeting. And they did. And
it worked.
It worked.
Yeah. How good are you? This is just a thought of my head. How good are you at like Rock and Roll Jeopardy? Like, could you beat a Gary Delabate?
You know, maybe.
I'd love to see that happen. Actually.
I would love to see that happen.
Because he's pretty darn good. I think the only person I've ever heard him get beat by was Hank the Angry Drunken Dwarf.
Is this a thing they do on Stern?
Yeah, Gary's was on Rock and Roll Jeopardy like two or three times.
I don't know how I wasn't on that show.
Sugar Ray was, Mark McGrath was actually, did he host it too? But he was actually really, really good at it too. I think
he went on to host it because Jeff Probst did the original Rock and Roll Jeopardy. Yeah, and then I think he came back around to be the host or whatever. What a weird career that dude has had.
Yeah.
I know, right? I just think about that the other day.
So strange.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a nice guy, though.
What he was. Know? He was a very nice guy.
Okay.
Yeah. Very nice guy.
Who was the biggest jerk to you?
Huh. It was a jerk. Very few people were jerks.
Really?
Yeah.
I think at the time, I think maybe people were less likely to be jerks, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, they knew to be nice to us.
Yeah, because I mean? You guys were MTV people.
Yeah.
You guys made their careers in a lot of ways.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, especially the young ones and like, the boy bands and the Britneys and Christinas and all them were so media coached and whatever. Okay. So like, I never knew what they were really like.
Right.
But they were nice. And it I will say that I, like Tom Cruise, nicest guy in the world. Jim Carrey, nicest guy in the world. Like all of the giant names that would come, like George Clooney, could not have been nicer. Like all the legendary people were fantastic. You know, like Kaya from The Real World Hawaii, a little difficult. You know what I mean? Like people who just didn't register at all would sometimes be difficult.
That's funny.
Just from living in LA most of my life and working on movies and whatever and meeting people, I realized that the reality show stars that were meaner than the actual ones that did stuff to get where they are.
Yeah, because they're terrified. Yeah.
I feel like they are the most entitled. Like they feel like they should be famous. Mm-hmm. Like automatically, like when I leave Big Brother, I should be famous forever.
And well,
it's just not like that.
What I think they're doing is what I did. I think that they are pretending to be stars. I think that they know that their time is limited. They know that like the opportunity to like break out from what they do is pretty slim, and so I think that they're just they're just terrified and holding on to the little tiny piece that they have, and acting like a bigger star so that someone will think they're a bigger star or whatever. I just think they're just trying to wring it out.
But why would somebody like you successful at doing something like that while most reality stars they just fizzle out and go away?
I don't know. I don't know.
Do you have a bigger drive, better drive?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. Honestly, I think that I continued to get work after MTV because I was pretty easy to work with. Because anybody can do when I host a show, let me go back. Like the first few shows that I hosted after MTV were pretty generic. You know, it was just like a lot of reading cue cards and like doing 20-second little stand-ups and whatever. And it was like, I was very aware of the fact that anybody could do what I did. So I tried to be nice. You know what I mean? Because I have seen people come and go. You know, I've seen people come in and be difficult and make demands. And it's like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
You're reading a cue card. Like 80 people want your job and we could get one here in an hour. You know, get out. So I didn't want to have that happen to me. But then also, I think a couple years of doing that, doing those generic shows that anybody could do, drove me a little bit crazy. And I was like, I got to start figuring out what it is that I love to do again so that I can like make a better future for myself. Because, you know, you can only do those like stand-up-y, cue card-y shows for a couple years.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I started doing more shit that I started writing more and all that and trying to do things that like engaged my whole brain.
Is that your love or what's your true love? Is it radio?
No. I mean, I do a little bit of radio now and I like it, but no, I can't say that that's necessarily like my true love. I am happiest when I am writing, when I'm like really in a zone. I'm actually happiest when I have written. Like writing itself is a total misery, but when I have written something that I'm proud of, that's the best I ever feel.
Yeah.
What do you think? What have you written that you're most proud of?
I have a book coming out in the end of June, which is a memoir of all of the dumb things that I did trying to be a normal person, and it's like it's very there's a lot of weird, painful, vulnerable stuff in there that I was on the fence about whether to write because it's strange to have that stuff out in the world. But it is, and it's like, and it, now people are starting to read it, and I'm starting to get feedback, and it feels really good. Like, I hate that I'm like, I felt good on my own having written it and finished it and all that. But now that I'm getting validation from other people, now it feels a lot better. I would like to detach from the need for validation, but I haven't done that yet.
Oh, you shouldn't. We need that.
We do. We do. I mean, it's only fair.
It's called Party of One.
It's called Party of One.
And you said it's not out yet.
It's not out yet. No, June 28th.
So you've passed it to friends?
Well, I have what are called galleys, which are like a few months before the book comes out, you get these versions of it that it's the pre-copy edited version. So there's still a couple like misplaced commas and whatever in there. It's not finished. But you send it out to reviewers and to people who can create buzz for it and whatever. And so that's
awesome.
That's gone out. Yeah, it's exciting.
That getting so people exciting. To write a foreword or like write a comment on the back.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You got to send it out to people to put blurbs on it. So yeah. I've done that. I've got my blurbs.
Is that uncomfortable or do you feel fine with that?
It was very uncomfortable.
Really?
Because it's.
Oh, I know exactly who I'd want to. Contact for that.
Oh, I knew Mel exactly Brooks who I wanted to. Oh, yeah, no, figuring out who was actually really easy, but asking, I just...
Really?
I don't,
I think I'd be difficult. Honored. If someone asked difficult. Me, I'd be honored to do it for them.
Read it's my whole thing. Book and then write something about me.
Yeah, and but it's also like, you read my book, like my book, and write something nice about it. That, I think, that's the part that I think is difficult, because it's like, if they don't like it, then they can't.
Dave takes us through a mediocre journey.
Yeah. Dave opens his heart and there's nothing there.
Actually I would need that for mine, because then it's like, well, I want to see what this piece of shit's about.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's a really good forward, actually.
Yeah. So asking for, what you're essentially doing is asking for a compliment. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and it puts you in a very difficult place. But I got all the people that I wanted, and that's great. A couple of them were slow, so then you have to be like, how's that compliment coming along? You know what I mean? Like, where's that compliment? Yeah, yeah. It's a very strange thing. But I got very lucky.
How's my butt look in this jeans? All right.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Times a million.
And you're proud of it, obviously.
I am. Yeah, I really am.
And can we pre-order it Amazon somewhere?
You sure can.
Okay.
All right, everybody.
I will
Please
do that.
Do.
Yeah, we will do that.
Party of One by Dave Holmes. Speaking of Dave Holmes.
Yes.
I'm sure people have said this to you before, but I mean, that's a name you picked in a sense, right? I mean, it's your real name.
It is, yeah.
But it's also a name you picked for a stage name. And there are just a bunch of Dave Holmes out there from Harry Potter's stunt double, who actually is paraplegic now. I don't know if you know that. Yeah, he got paralyzed on one of the stunts.
Oh, fuck.
Dave Holmes.
God,
wow.
There's Coldplay's manager, who's questionable with women.
Yep. By the way. I guess he goes out with Azalea Banks, or did.
Right.
And she accused him of hitting her. And a whole lot of gossip websites published that story with my picture.
Oh, shit.
And yeah, so that was like, that was a very easy thing to ask people to do, take down my picture. Like, because I was shaking with righteous anger. Because I was, Twitter doesn't fucking check facts at all.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
They're just like, they don't know that I'm the gayest.
The internet doesn't check facts.
Would not, I don't date women. I wouldn't hit women. Like, I got fucking, people on Twitter went fucking bananas.
Oh, plus, Azalea Banks, she's like pro-Trump.
Which
freaks me out a little bit, frankly. Every celebrity that's been backing Trump has been like, all right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Buckle up, people.
Yeah, all three of them. Scott Baio?
Scott Baio.
Kid Rock. Don't forget Kid
Rock.
Yes, because he's
Man, what, I mean, why couldn't... Why do we live in a world where there's a Ted Nugent and not a Prince?
I know. Someone said
it's
that.
So fucking awful.
It's really bizarre.
And it's gross. Yikes.
Did you have a favorite show that you did on MTV?
I think, I did a show called Video Clichés, which I also wrote on, which I loved.
Oh, I remember that show. I loved it.
It was really, really fun. And it was all about, the tropes of music video. The fisheye lens in the hip-hop video. Lead singer in drag, dry ice smoke, whatever. It would be like a montage of women in fishnet and then a new video that it had a woman in fishnet. And there was like a countdown clock, like 10 seconds.
Cliche
until woman
in. I remember that show. I remember great. You guys did Madonna's Frozen video
once. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And because you were doing like morphing animals.
Uh-huh.
Yep. And I just was like, yeah, she always does that.
Yeah.
And then Michael Jackson wanted
it. Yeah, yeah.
I was a fan.
I loved that. Ooh. That was so much fun.
I miss MTV when they did stuff like that. And VH1 had pop-up video, which I used to like a lot.
Yeah.
Which, And so I went to a meeting at MTV in November where I ran into you, actually, on the street near Google. So I was there at, MTV, and they were completely rebranding now, and they're only doing, like, music shows.
Yeah.
So I was just pitching them ideas.
That's so great. I'm so happy about that. Because, and that was what was so awesome about MTV was the people behind the scenes. Like, it was, you know, all the glitzy shit and the parties and whatever, it was fine, but, like, I was a little too old for it, and I'm not, you know, I don't know. I just... That part of it didn't really connect with me, but like being in a conference room with a bunch of really smart people coming up with show ideas and whatever, even if they were dumb show ideas, because a lot of it was like spring break stuff where it was like, how do we get young girls wet? You know, like, I mean, like not wet, right, but like, how do we dump water on young women? And it was dumb, but it was like, it was fun to come up with dumb ideas with smart people. It just made me so happy.
And I think it made, music and artists better artists.
Yeah.
Because they were like, oh crap, well, it's like having a gallery for people to look at. So it's like, oh, I better step up my game and better, I have to outdo it, and I have to really make this a piece and a commentary because I'm having an influence on people. And I think artists got lazy in that period where, you know, VH1 kind of went away, and then MTV just had just like, you know, Jersey Shore and 13 and Pregnant or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think artists got lazy and they made not so good music videos. And it was just Ariana Grande, you know.
Well, there was nowhere to put them, so there was no budget for them.
Right.
And
And they used to mean something. Like, I specifically remember the first time I went to my friend Seth's house and they had cable. We didn't have cable. And we turned on MTV. And I saw the first video I ever saw, which was Phil Collins. I don't even know the real name of the song. It's always the same. It's just a shame. that's all.
Yeah.
And he had they're the guys, the bums with the with the over the fire and all that shit. Yeah. I mean, but that was like a huge deal. I remember walking into my parents' room. I'm not going to tell the whole story, but and seeing Wham on the screen and my dad probably making some inappropriate comments. I'm just going to say, you know, he didn't know better at the time.
Yeah.
Like, there are moments, and those videos are like part of it. They're part of your life. Like, they were much bigger than just like, hey, a video's on the screen. Like, it actually you know what the biggest thing I remember was? I went to the roller skating rink, the Brick Roller Forum, and I went into their teen club called Body Rock to watch the premiere of Thriller.
Oh wow.
But before Thriller, It's Raining Men. So I do still remember the video for It's Raining Men. That was the only time I've ever seen it. And I also remember like a bunch of teenagers standing in this room that smelled like pot and wet floors for some reason. And you couldn't wear your roller skates in there. And we watched the video for Thriller. It was like this huge deal just watching a video.
Yeah.
And now people don't think about that kind of stuff. It's not the same.
I mean, they probably do. They probably go on YouTube and look at them over and over.
But do they?
I don't know.
Maybe they don't. But yeah, no, I totally remember. And like, you would just watch them over and over and over, you know?
Yeah.
I would anyway.
I totally think it made music artists better artists. Mm-hmm. And it stepped up their game, and they had to think more about what they were doing and their image that they were putting out there and the effect it was having on the youth.
Right.
And I remember, like, even just like the Rock the Vote thing, that was such a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not, like, if MTV did that, it's like, you guys are like peanuts compared to like Bernie's whole thing, you know, this whole grassroots movement. So I don't know.
You know what I miss is, and they did it. I mean, they started playing Prince videos for a little bit on MTV the other day. But when David Bowie died, it was like, you know, where 5-10 years ago, you would have turned on MTV because they would be talking to all of the people, you know, all the famous people who wanted to call in, and, you know, all the people that he worked with who wanted to eulogize him, or they'd play his videos or play a concert or whatever. Like, there was a place to go if something significant in music happened. And now it's like that doesn't exist anymore. Like, what the fuck are you gonna turn on CNN?
No, Twitter's better for that.
Really? I guess it is, but it's also, yeah, Twitter is there and YouTube is there, but there's no sense of curation to it at all. It's just it's just stuff. And like, I don't know.
And plus I feel like with CNN, like I was watching it today and they were doing a lot of Prince stuff and talking to his managers. But then every 5 minutes they'll be like, and this is what Cruz has to say today.
Yeah, get out of here.
It's like, I don't want that mixed with my Prince love.
Yeah, get him out. Yeah. He is the anti-Prince.
So we bring Kurt Loder back and let's just have the whole MTV News crew.
I think
he works at Reason now.
Oh, really?
It's a Reason magazine, yeah.
I think, did all the VJs start working at magazines?
Maybe, yeah. I mean,
it seems like a natural progression, no?
It does kind of, doesn't it? Yeah, Duff is, I forget where she's working now, but she's just finished another book. Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
Either.
But are you happy with your trajectory from
absolutely.
MTV?
Yeah, that's good. Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely am.
We're going to talk about what you're doing now and all that stuff. Let me just ask you this question. What do you think your biggest failure has been?
Ooh, that's my biggest failure.
Or if you can't think of one, tell me your thoughts on failure.
No, you know, I fail frequently. It's like I'm just going through my mental catalog.
Most significant.
I failed out of college.
Oh, really?
Yeah, after my freshman year. And I got back in after a year. It was actually more of a suspension, but I basically failed out because I never went to class. That was a pretty significant failure. I wish that I could say that I learned from it because it was the universe clearly sending me a message that I was barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah.
But I continued to bark up that tree. And I wish now, looking back, that I had just been like, okay, this is a sign. I don't belong there. I went to a place that was very conservative and very, like I was, like I said, trying to turn myself into like a normal person. And I'm not. I should have gone to a place, I think, where I could have studied media, or I could have studied, there was a theater group, but like where I could have gotten more, I could have gotten started on my career a few years earlier. Mm-hmm. Who knows what kind of nightmare Cokehead studio guy I would be if I had gone down that road. No. But I didn't do it. And so because of that, I did not have a great college experience. I think I was really denying my true self all through it. That whole thing, I think, was a failure. And it has made me, now that I have, in a roundabout way, found my place in the world, it makes me that much more like tenacious about making sure that I'm getting everything that I can out of it. You know what I mean?
I feel the same way, I think. I didn't do well in college. And I think a lot of people go to college just, they choose a college when they're in a vulnerable place in their lives.
Yeah.
Like, well, I got to do something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they don't necessarily belong there. So they're like, I'm weird. I don't fit in. And do I just soldier on?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. You're right.
Yeah.
Eventually, when you get out of that trajectory, you'll be stronger. And
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, I think I'm glad that I took the path that I took because I'm in a place where I'm happy. And so that's all good. And I got some stories out of it and I sold a book.
You know what
I mean? So that's great. But I know some people who just like knew exactly what they wanted to do and they pursued it, and they pursued it at the right place, and they met terrific people that they're like bonded with for the rest of their life. And it's like, I don't know what that feels like at all. I have great friends from college who I love a lot, but I don't like, I think I was showing a counterfeit version of myself that whole time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've, as an adult, I am like super cautious about never doing that again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like really, like almost to a point, to a fault. I mean,
I don't even talk to anyone from college. I hated college so much.
Where'd you go?
UCSB.
Okay.
And I dropped out my junior year because I hated it so much.
Yeah.
And I didn't talk to anyone. Mm-hmm. Like, it's funny, on Facebook, I'm still friends with people, but like I'm actually more in touch with people from high school than I am from college. College, I completely like disconnected.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I'm the same way.
But again, I think as an adult, like what makes people an adult, besides, you know, just paying taxes and doing all the boring stuff, is I think just you have the experience behind you that you've learned. You failed to, you know, learn how to be a better person and a happier person.
Yeah. One more thing about failure. One way that I have failed often and will continue to is on stage, like doing improv.
Really?
That was, yeah. I mean, because, and that's one of the things that kind of drew me to it, was that like I was so vain at first about like never doing something unless I knew that I would be great at it, because I didn't want to fail publicly.
Mm.
And like, if you do improv, you will have a shitty show. Like the best people in the world frequently have shitty shows, or are the weak link in a great show or whatever. You know what I mean? They fail a lot. And like it's just a part of the thing, and it never feels good. You always want to succeed rather than fail, but like you have to fail. You have to fail publicly. You have to just eat a dick on a stage sometimes and like in front of people and get embarrassed and just be like, okay, well, I didn't die.
Do you like doing improv now?
You know, I haven't done it in a long time.
Oh, really?
I need to get back into
it. You should get back into
it. I want to get back into it just because I want to get as much stage, like I want to get as much time like in front of people as possible before this thing comes out.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case, like I get really lucky publicity wise and I get to do some shows and stuff. I want to be in practice. You know what I mean? I want to have warmed up.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if I am lucky enough to book like a talk show, I want to show up primed. You know what I mean? Like I've gotten a bunch of stage time, so I'm ready to go.
Can we get him on Ellen? with Andy?
I don't know. Let's try. You know, I passed along a story to Andy who passed it on to another producer. I don't know if it was about this little girl who has cancer and she met like this really huge black guy. That, I don't know if you, there was like this meme going or a picture going around where he about on the back of his shirt, it said strong and then it said stronger on the bottom and there was an arrow pointing to this little girl. Yeah. And her whole thing was that she wanted to be on the Ellen show. So I was like,
oh, you got her on Ellen.
So I just emailed Andy and I'm like, Andy Lassner, I'm like, hey man, I don't know if you saw this and I hate to be that guy, but this girl's so sweet. She's like an 8-year-old girl dying of cancer. How could I not try? And he said, oh, actually, I just passed it along to some of the
technical producers or whatever. I was not asking.
But we have connections, though.
Well,
so
we'll just talk to Andy Lassner.
Cool. Yeah.
Wow, how are you feeling? How about Zeb?
There you go.
Zeb will take him.
So here's something you did recently that I loved, and I'm actually kind of doing something very similar myself.
Yeah.
I don't know what got me to do that, but you received a call.
Yes.
From somebody telling you that there was a problem with your taxes. Oh, this is the best thing ever.
Yes. Yeah.
I have to compliment you after International Waters about this.
Thanks.
Because I was like, this is the coolest thing ever.
Thanks. I can't believe how much that took off. That was crazy. but yeah, okay. So I only mentioned that I was coming from the gym so that I can explain that my brain was not right. Like I was not... I was very like tired and woozy and whatever, and I was like, I wasn't thinking straight. And so I got in my car and there was a message from some like Maryland or Delaware number or something, I think Maryland, that I didn't recognize. And I listened to the message and it was a recording that said it was the IRS and that there's a lawsuit against me and I need to call right away and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, and I panicked because again, I wasn't thinking straight. I was like, I mean, if I was in my right mind, I would know the IRS doesn't call you. The IRS is not going to
start
a lawsuit. They don't know my cell number.
Yeah.
Exactly. And like all of my shit goes through, like I have a tax person and whatever they have to contact them first. Like none of it made sense, but I wasn't thinking straight. So I called back and a very angry voiced sort of Pakistani sounding guy picked up and told me that like I owed them $4,000 or something, and there was a warrant out for my arrest and they canceled my driver's license and so I could be taken to jail. And they had come to my house and they left a summons or whatever, but I didn't respond, so they thought I was trying to get away or whatever. And like my heart was racing, and then just the more that I heard this guy talk, I was like, oh no, this is just a scam. This is a really bad scam. And so by that time I was on my way to record. Actually, I was going to Sirius right around the corner from here. And I was going to record and I was like, well, I'm gonna be in traffic for 20 minutes. I'm gonna fuck with these people. So I did, and it was really fun. And I just kept them on the line and they told me that I had to go to a Bank of America. I had to go to my bank and withdraw cash. I couldn't do it in ATM because it was like $4,000 or $5,000. And then I had to go and bring the cash to a Bank of America and put it into this person's account. And just like all of it makes no fuck. I mean, like there's no world in which, like, this is not how the world works. It's just not. It
sounds
doesn't
like
make
a
sense.
Cartoon.
It's like. It's like a terrible cartoon. And so I was like, I stayed on the line and I made myself cry, which my dog had just died. It was very easy for me to make myself
Thank
cry.
Thank God for the improv lessons, right?
Yeah, right. So I was like crying and like begging them not to take me to jail. And they were like, well, I mean, but you have to do what we say. We'll do it. And so I just kept on the line for a long time and I tried to record it, but you can't. I was on the phone. And so you can't, like, I couldn't use my voice memos because I was on the phone part of it, which is a tragedy because I would love to have posted the whole audio. But yeah, so I fucked with them for a long time. And then I got close to Sirius and it was like, all right, it's time for me to go. And I just started yelling at this guy who I was on the phone with because, I mean, like, he didn't get me, but he's going to get somebody.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he's going to get some ding-dong who, like, doesn't know the things, you know, it just doesn't have common sense, but does have $3,000 and probably not a cent more in the bank. And like, they'll clear it out and they'll fucking give it to these people.
I was listening to a Planet Money podcast and they were just talking about that.
Where really?
They interviewed someone that used to work for those companies and they talked to them about their like tactics. And you listen on the phone, they talked to some other like old woman, like, and they asked her for like money she didn't have.
Uh-huh.
And she's like, oh, well, can you look in your savings? She's like, well, that's kind of a rainy day thing. And they made her like clean it out. Isn't that nuts? Yeah.
Ooh,
I know.
That's so nuts. Horrible. And just so sad. And it made me furious. But again, like it was one of those things where I was filled with righteous anger.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, like I've never felt righter in the world about telling somebody to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it like, there is no other argument. go fuck yourself is the only right argument. You right. know?
One of the funny things you did was though you said like you said like you were going to the bank, and then you're like, I'm going to tell them that this is for the CIA just so they're clear.
Yeah,
and they're
yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, for no, no. IRS. It has yeah, to be
yeah.
the IRS.
Yeah, yeah. IRS, yeah. No, you can't do that. It's illegal for you to talk about it. I was like, oh, fuck you. Fuck you. Yeah, but then I
there's a new book premise right there. Sure.
But on the drive home, I called a friend and I told him the story because it was still making me laugh. And he was like, you have to write this down. Like, you have to write it down. I was like, oh, I'm going to do it on Twitter. So I just started telling the story on Twitter. And as I was telling it, I noticed like I was getting like a billion mentions and like a whole ton of new people were following me. And I was like, oh shit, this is like, I've gathered people around a campfire here.
Yeah.
And it was.
Thank
it was,
God you did, because then it like really alerts people.
That was the other thing, is that I really wanted people to know.
You saved someone else from being scammed.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then I reported the account numbers. I went. There was a Bank of America near my house, and I went to and I gave them the account numbers and all that. And like I wanted to know what they were going to do with it. Like I really wanted to follow them for the rest of the day, but they were like, "No, you have to. You can't. You have to go." I was like, "All right.
Bummer.
Thanks for the info, but
yeah." Bye.
Well, good for you. I mean, if you gave the bank account numbers, you definitely saved at least one person from being scammed. So good for you.
The fact that it went like viral basically made it so you saved a lot of people.
It was so crazy. That was the weirdest thing in the world.
That is nuts.
It's funny because just earlier this week, before I even like, because I researched you and I was like, oh yeah, I forgot that Dave did that. I got a spam to my, I'm one of those to my inbox. Uh-huh. And it was just so outrageous that I felt like answering it.
Yeah.
Because it was like, preferred username, preferred password, and like just shit that was like, who the fuck is giving out, like, because you know username and password, they're just gonna go try that on eBay and Citibank and all that so I'm in a conversation right now with a scammer, and I've given him my quote-unquote information and all that stuff, and I'm just gonna mess with them for a little bit.
You absolutely should I mean, because it like it's, you know, 5 minutes they can't spend on somebody else.
Exactly you know? And it's so weird how like the scam has not changed. It's still Nigerian bank with a. Yeah. I have $10 million. It's Nigeria. Like,
it's a sucker. Oh, yeah.
I'm
every
a
day.
Princess, apparently.
Say Tasmania, at least. Like, say somewhere different where I'm not like, oh, this is the Nigerian scam. Like, scam goes with Nigerian.
There will be
point.
Somebody who hasn't seen it, you know?
Unbelievable.
That really made me angry. But the fact that it went kind of viral and people started writing about it and whatever was great. And a lot of fun, and I was so happy that it was because of something good that I did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, like, as it was happening, I was like, if this was because of some dumb thing that I said whatever, or some, like, accidentally racist thing that I said or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just whatever. Like, because there are a million ways you can fuck up in this world, and people jump on it. I've jumped on it. And it was fun to watch it happen, but it was also like, oh, it's like a bar of soap. Like, you can't hold on. It just, like, slips out of your hands, and then it's just, like, it's just gone.
Yeah.
And, like, I was very happy in the moment that it was because of a positive.
And are you, like, sitting there watching your mentions go along, like, the whole night, or at some point did you put it down?
Sort of, and then it was, like, and then, like, Slate did a thing, and Wired did a thing, and, like, and it was just, like, then it was, like, real media was talking about it. It was very strange.
That is strange.
Very, very strange.
Viral things are weird.
Yeah.
I've been involved in viral, and it's, and there's no rhyme or reason.
No.
Like, you can't predict what's going to be viral. You can't sit there and be like, this is going to go viral. You have no control over it.
No, you don't.
But
that's why I love when people are like, we need to make a viral video.
I know, right?
Great. You also want to have a hit song?
Right, exactly. Exactly. And winning lottery numbers.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Let's go get a winning lottery ticket.
Let's talk about what you're doing now. You're currently still hosting the daily video podcast, The Drink with Dave. You're not.
No, that's been... what I'm not doing is fixing my Wikipedia page.
Did that start, though? But that started as a Kickstarter, right?
Well, sort of. We were going to kickstart a second season, and then everything kind of, like, the producer moved away, and just everything kind of fell apart. But that literally was just like, I was having drinks with this guy who, I don't even know how, I host this storytelling show, and he had been one of the co-producers of it for a while. And he was like, what kind of show do you want to do? And we started talking about it, and he was like, well, let's just do it. Like, you know people with cameras, you know, we have a location, like, let's just do a bunch of episodes of a show with just, like people from LA that we'd like to bring some attention to. And it was like, oh, yeah, sometimes life really is that easy.
Yeah.
You know, you can just do it. So we did. We did a bunch of episodes, and it was a lot of fun. And it didn't really, like, turn into anything bigger, but it was fun to do, and it was like, I think I was at the end of a few years of doing those kinds of shows that I was telling you about that anybody could do.
Yeah.
And I was feeling a little like, like the wind had been a little bit knocked out of my sails with TV, and it was like I was not making money yet as a writer. I hadn't really even thought about that being an option. And so like that show kind of woke me up to the possibility of just like, you can do whatever the fuck you want in this world.
You can.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You really can. Especially here. You know what I mean? Yeah.
And LA, you have so much at your disposal.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a whole internet. There's, you know, there's like, everybody has an equal shot at getting, you know, eyeballs and ear holes and whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so from that, I started writing more, and then I like begged my way into a job at Vulture, recapping X Factor. Which was like the first time I'd ever been paid to write like print. I mean, it's internet, but like for a magazine or a website of any kind. And so from that, I started doing a regular column, and then I moved over to Esquire. I'm now editor at large for Esquire.com. And then from that got this book deal and all that. So right now I'm just trying to, you know, I'm writing up a storm.
That's huge.
It's fun.
Are you doing the other podcast though? The
International Waters?
Yes.
Yes.
So we still argue.
Yes, was just, that's how I met Dave.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. You actually, we met on the street.
We did meet on the street, yes. Yeah. But besides that. And then we met
in the studio. Yeah, it's a really fun like panel show. We have a couple of comics in the studio in Los Angeles, and then we have a couple over Skype from a studio in London.
It's like an Audible, I think, at midnight type thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Type show. You should do more improv shows. I'm really...
I'm going to, for sure.
I think
for
you should totally do that.
Yeah.
And of course, you're Dave Holmes on Twitter. For anybody who wants to follow,
I came from brunch.
It's nobody. Sorry, we can't smell it or anything. Okay, nobody will tell on you. Good. Let me ask you this question to kind of to wrap it up. Do you have a favorite charity?
Do I have a favorite charity? I do. Let's see. Maybe the Center for Supportive Housing.
Okay.
Corporation for Supportive Housing. It's in downtown Los Angeles, and they look to find subsidized and supportive housing for homeless people. We have.
That's a great charity. So I'm going to give $150 to that charity. Oh. Yes.
We do it.
That's
every,
part of
every
failing
show.
Up. We always give a little to that. Charity, to the favorite charity.
That's great.
And of course, there'll be a link to that charity in the bio for you, or the summary of the podcast.
Great.
So, all right, cool.
Awesome.
So, Dave Holmes, we really appreciate you spending time with us today. Thank you so much. You're a huge success, and I wish you more success.
Thank you very much.
And I hope everyone pre-orders your book.
Yes, thank you. And go buy Party of One.
If you do,
on Amazon.
If you do, and you drop me a line at daveholmesparty@gmail.com, send your proof of pre-order, I will make you a 21 song mixtape.
Oh my God!
Or Apple Music, because the book itself is kind of a playlist.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's
okay. You can't have a dinner party without it.
No, you really can't. Yeah. You shouldn't. You're responsible.
Done and done. Thank you so much, Dave. Nice
meeting
you.